Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me today is a man who, for some of our listeners, needs no introduction. As poet in residence at the American Jazz Museum, Glenn North has been a mobilizing force in Kansas City's spoken word scene. In just a decade's time, Glenn built a community from the ground up. When we got word of his plans to resign from the American Jazz Museum, we wanted to take the opportunity to look back on the last 10 years and to find out what's next for Glenn North. Hi, Glenn. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations on this milestone. How are you feeling?
Well, mixed emotions, quite frankly. The American Jazz Museum and the work that I did there, of course, with spoken word, but in many other areas as well, became part of my identity, so to speak. So I've not felt that way about other positions that I've had. And so the decision to leave was a difficult one. But I'm very excited about what's in store. And, you know, growth is important. And sometimes you have to make those grown-up decisions so that you can move forward.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get back to what's next for you later in the show, but I want to sort of travel back in time with you. How did you first get involved with the American Jazz Museum?
Well, the very first time I got paid for performing a poem was the weekend of the grand opening celebration of the American Jazz Museum. And from that point on, I just had a relationship with the museum. I loved the institution. I would go and hang out in the atrium sometimes to write poems because there's just such a creative environment. And I always thought, like, what a great job this would be. But I had never pictured myself working in a museum. So I began hosting an event called A Verbal Attack shortly after the museum opened. And it was kind of different than other poetry readings that were going on in Kansas City at the time. So as a result of the popularity of that program, the museum asked me to do a series of workshops that explored the relationship between jazz and poetry for young people. And that was very successful. And the relationship just evolved. And eventually I was hired in the education department in 2004 and was given a platform at that point and an opportunity to really expand the poetry programming at the museum.
So when you were hired by the American Jazz Museum, and remind me, what year is this?
2004.
What was it like then at 18th and Vine? And what was your vision for the museum and the district that maybe went beyond what you were seeing already there in front of you?
Well, I came to understand how vital Kansas City had been in terms of the evolution of jazz music. And I think, like most people who live here, I really expected this bustling, energetic, vibrant kind of scene. And the museum, in many ways, is the anchor for that. But when I first started working there, you know, just the volume of tours, because I would, you know, facilitate tours through our permanent exhibit, the newness of it, finding out how many different things go into running a museum, finding out, to be quite honest with you, how political Kansas City's arts and culture scene is. And we're not unique in that, but I just was not prepared for that.
Well, yeah. Tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, there are all of these different perceptions about 18th and Vine. Once I started working there and became kind of a representative for the museum, you know, you would get questions from suburbanites like, is it safe down there? Or because the vibrancy that everybody anticipated wasn't a microwave kind of thing, it's probably more of a slow boil. You know, you get questions from people who don't frequent the museum. Like, there's this perception that things aren't moving fast enough. And how are things going down there? You know, and so I became very protective in terms of helping people to understand that we do a lot. And there's a lot to be celebrated. But oftentimes, you know, without trying to stir up any controversy, I think that you know, sometimes support and funding goes to organizations other than the museum. Let me just say it like that.
Well, what do you think accounts for that?
Like I said, sometimes perception. perhaps sometimes race. We're still dealing with all of those issues, even with President Obama in office. I don't think that we have necessarily arrived at a place where we are a post-race nation. And so I think that in many ways, and I think people might disagree with me, but I've heard that in other cities they experience similar things. But the community, I think, if they really understood how important this history is and how important an institution like the Jazz Museum is, that there might be more just grassroots support for the museum.
You know, what's interesting is, like, I think if you just do a quick drive-by of 18th and Vine on a random Tuesday or something, you might not see, like, the kind of hustle and bustle that you would expect, like you were saying,
right.
And that there are moments where there are events that go on that do draw huge crowds
right.
and lots of vibrant energy.
Uh-huh.
And I think that it would, if a person happened to catch a glimpse at maybe the wrong moment, it could be understandable
sure.
that they would think that there's not a lot going on.
Right.
How do you get from here to there, so to speak? How do you get what is starting to happen there to grow into something that's more of a day-to-day kind of thing? Or is that the goal?
Yeah, absolutely that's the goal. And I'm more of an artist than a business visionary, but just in terms of my experiences there, I think that there has to be a real campaign to deal with the perception and to get everybody on the same page in terms of the community really rallying around the museum. And whatever mistakes have been made in the past, I'm sure there's plenty of blame to go around, me included. There are a lot of things that I could have done differently or better. But we have to figure out a way to make the community believe in the institution. And then we have to figure out a way to get anchor businesses in the community, in the district. You know, a mall that doesn't have certain stores, you know, the larger chains, oftentimes won't do well. So there needs to be something financially, like the museum is the cultural institution that kind of anchors things, but there needs to be a financial anchor, some kind of chain, and I don't necessarily want it to turn into just, you know how you can go to Manhattan now, but you can go to New York and you want to go to Times Square and then there's Applebee's and there's the same, there's Hardee's, there's the same exact thing that you see at home. So I think that it definitely needs to have a unique kind of feeling. You know, you don't want it to look like a strip mall. But at the same time, there needs to be vibrant businesses that have proven to be sustainable, that create the kind of economic structure that's necessary for that kind of growth and success.
Well, you've mentioned that you're more of an artist than a business visionary, and I want to talk to you about your background with the arts. What is your background with the arts?
It started when I was 8 years old. My grandmother, for my 8th birthday, got she typically gave me really cool presents back when I was growing up. It was Rock'em Sock'em Robots and Hot Wheels, whatever the hot toy was, my grandmother got it for me. But on my 8th birthday, she just gave me a copy of the poem If by Rudyard Kipling, and she challenged me to memorize it. And I was really kind of salty about that at first. I, at that point, didn't have a love of poetry, but I did what she asked. My grandmother wasn't a teacher, and sometimes she would trick me into learning things. And so once I memorized the poem and was able to share it with her, I was really proud of that.
Do you still have it memorized?
Yeah.
Can we hear it?
If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, not give way to hating, and yet not look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster, and treat those two imposters just the same. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can walk with kings and keep your virtue, or walk with crowds nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, then yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And which is more, you'll be a man, my son.
Oh, my gosh. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Glenn North, who just recited Rudyard Kipling's If, which he memorized when he was 8. Glenn's leaving the American Jazz Museum, and we're looking back at the past decade with him and looking forward as well. So, Glenn, you've had that in your head since you were 8. How does it affect you to carry that with you?
Well, the thing my grandmother wanted to instill in me is the philosophy that's conveyed in that poem about how you should live your life. And the love of poetry has been with me ever since. And then as you fall in love with poetry and literature, then music and visual art and dance and theater, all of those things you start to find out are different expressions of kind of the same thing. You know, we're all trying to communicate something that is beautiful and that contains truth. And those are just different methods of communicating that truth. And I'm always interested in terms of my general love of the arts. Obviously, I'm a poet, but I try to see how poetry connects with all those other disciplines and how it can be used. This might sound a little naive, but how it can be used to really lift people up and build community.
Well, speaking of that, tell us about the Jazz Poetry Jams. How did that series get started? And was it always the standing room only crowd it can be sometimes today, or did that evolve gradually?
Well, it was a little of both. And to be honest with you, I really want to give credit to Adri Taylor, who came up with the whole concept in terms of how the evening plays out. So it's from like 7 to 10, and the band plays. We have a house band that plays for half an hour. We typically have a featured poet each month that will perform for half an hour. And then we'll go into the open mic. And we'll have judges in the audience. So it's like a slam, but we don't take ourselves too seriously as a slam. You know what I mean? Like, it's just kind of a thing to create some extra tension and excitement for the audience and for the poets to hopefully continue to work on their writing so that they get better and to work on their performance. And at the end of the night, the judges, you know, we tally the scores, and the person with the most scores, with the most points, rather, goes home with $100, which is not bad. There are not a lot of rich poets running around. And so I looked at it like over the course of the 10 years, and I meant to bring the document with me, but we were also very interested in making sure that poets and artists got paid for their work. And so we've been one of the largest employers of poets in the Midwest over the past 10 years. And we've awarded over $25,000 in cash money over that time. So,
man.
Yeah.
Well, so that event, the music is a big part of it.
Yes.
What is the role of music in what is essentially a poetry spoken word event?
Mm-hmm. Well, because we want to continually explore the relationship between jazz and poetry, and we want to introduce jazz to a different audience. You know, I didn't grow up listening to jazz. I grew up listening to hip hop. And so and I'm 48. So, you know, the generations that have come after me certainly have not been hearing jazz on the radio, you know, that kind of thing. So that is a way to keep with the mission of the museum of really helping people to understand the importance of jazz and to celebrate it. So that's that. But then there's also just this inherent relationship, because poetry is about the music of language. And by listening to music, you can, your poetry can be informed in different ways in terms of cadence and rhythm and other nuances that I think are really important for people to explore.
Well, you do other kinds of spoken word events as well. A lot of them involve high schools and younger people. Can you talk about the last spoken word event you did with the American Jazz Museum? That was an event called Louder Than a Bomb.
Yeah, that was really huge. And I found out that there was this festival in Chicago called Louder Than a Bomb that had been successful over the past 14 years. They produced a documentary that was really powerful. It's also called Louder Than a Bomb. With the success of that documentary, many other cities wanted to know how they could start something that would really be a way to transform youth culture in the various cities that wanted to do it. And so the Young Chicago Audiences, which is the organization that sponsors it, put together a toolkit with pedagogy and methodology so that it could be implemented in other cities. And then they're very hands-on about helping you to organize the event. So when I first started that conversation with Young Chicago Authors, I found out that there was a teacher at Washington High School, Paul Richardson, who had been on the same path. So they asked us to work together, and I say this all the time, but thank God for Paul, because he's a lot better at like the administrative communications kind of thing. And I was probably helpful in kind of helping people to understand like the kind of vibe we wanted to have, so the kids are really excited and interested. And the museum was very supportive of that. And so this past March, we had our first annual LTAB, KC. LTAB is the acronym for Louder Than a Bomb. And it went off much better than we had even hoped for. I mean, to see, we had 13 high schools that were participating in quarterfinal, semifinal, and, you know, then it came down to the finals. But, you know, kind of like the, it was our own March Madness, so to speak. But to see 200-300 kids in a room cheering on their friends with signs and screaming for them like you would see at a football game or at a basketball game was amazing. And so the team from Paseo won, and we're in the process now of communicating with, I've also coached Kansas City's youth poetry slam team that competes at another competition called Brave New Voices. So we're getting the Paseo team prepared to go to that national competition now.
We've got a clip from this Louder Than a Bomb event, and I want to hear one of the young poets perform. When we come back from this clip, I'll let you explain who she is and what her story is.
Sure.
I am louder than a bomb. I said that I am louder than a bomb, cause the streets I come from be eardrums deaf dumb, and silence only comes in my dreams. It seems we live in a world of contradicting fantasies. My people got suicidal tendencies, and even without the same blood, you could be considered family. It seems I'm on the path to self-destruction, crushing lies told by wolves in sheep clothing, holding the final chapters of my history. Fatal signs designed to keep us in line, prime example, saving like a tasteful sample of a people we were conditioned not to trust. Cause every time I look in the mirror, I'm reminded that that people is us. Certainly the uncertainty behind our identity should provide us with a lifetime of lifelines, but the political divide tied critical ties necessary for hood revolutionaries to emerge. Time splurged on the color difference, so the only way to survive is to convert. The block has been seized and searched, planting seeds in earth, giving birth to a political regime that gives black people self-worth. My focus is breaking the master's curse before my brother's blood leaks through my shirt, because dreams in the hood really do become deferred. So I prefer that you approach me politically correct. Think twice before you let ignorance slip your lips. Cause my crew comes through with pens deadlier than text. That's our weapon of choice. Because freedom of speech doesn't matter unless you recognize your voice. And mine just so happens to be louder than a bomb.
All right, we got...
Okay, so we're back, and one thing I should explain is that there were a couple of moments there when you heard a pause, and that's where we did do some careful editing because of language.
Sure. That was Shani Brunson, who actually wrote that poem when she found out that we were actually going to do this. So Shani had been a member of the Brave New Voices team. She wasn't participating in Louder Than a Bomb, but that's the poem that she wrote that we would use to reach other young people to kind of show them how the spoken word thing works and what Louder Than a Bomb was all about. So that was kind of like a promotional poem.
Well, it's very effective. She tackles some difficult material in it, which is not what promotional materials are known for.
But it's what spoken word is known for. And, you know, there's just something about the art that it wants to confront issues. It wants to challenge people. I think that when you begin writing spoken word poems, that's just one of the things that people who do this are about, like building community and challenging the status quo.
What does make spoken word different from other kinds of poetry?
Well, I think it's really simple. Spoken word is written with the intent to be performed. So there's a different kind of immediacy that the artist is thinking about, as opposed to someone who's writing a poem for publication. You know, you can incorporate more symbolism and, you know, use of interesting syntax and things like that in a poem that somebody's going to read maybe three or four times and try to unpack. With spoken word, you only have the moment. And so you want to be able to connect with people in a way that's different than literary poetry.
What do you see as the future of spoken word in Kansas City and maybe even beyond Kansas City? Do you feel like you've created something here that, I mean, not to be too cheesy, but like that sprouted wings and can fly on its own?
I would like to think I've been a part of that. Yeah. And I think it's evident. I started hosting a small event on 19th and Vine at the Mardi Gras called Verbal Attack 17 years ago. And I've been involved in poetry and spoken word in some way ever since. Not necessarily because I'm the only one that's doing it. It's just that there's room for it because more and more people are embracing it. And obviously, working with young people, I feel is important because it helps them to find their voice. It helps them to understand that their voice matters. I've seen it heal. You know, there are stories that I can tell. I know we don't have a whole lot of time on the radio.
But maybe tell one of them quickly.
Well, the most profound one was with Brandon Bushnell Smith, who was on the Brave New Voices team 2 years ago and hanging out with a group of his friends one night. They were in his car, but he asked his friend to drive because they had gone to a hamburger joint and he wanted to be able to eat while his friend drove. And they were parked and doing what kids do. And some unknown assailant just walked up to them and shot up the car. You know, Brandon watched his best friend fall over dead in his lap. Brandon got shot in the spine. The bullet is still there. And that was right before we were planning on going to Brave New Voices. I won't say right before, but a couple of months before. So once Brandon was up and you know, still dealing with grief, of course, but also preparing to go to this trip, he decided that he wanted to write a poem about that experience. And, you know, I told him that I don't know that you can expect a poem to fix all of the things that you're struggling with right now. And it might be that it's too soon for you to be able to really write something that you're going to feel confident about by the time we go to California. It was in California that year. And he was just determined. So we went through that process. And, you know, the first couple of drafts, you know, were not necessarily great. And we had to have that conversation, which was very difficult. But I made him understand that I wasn't judging his experience. But if he wanted to compete with a poem, we need to make sure that it's a really good poem. And Brandon put in that work and the team rallied around him. And when we went to Brave New Voices that year, although we didn't win, we beat the team from New York,
Whoa. Which
was a victory because they're like a machine. It was like, you know, the Royals playing the Yankees. You know, it was a huge deal. And to see him perform that piece, you know, to see him get a standing ovation, to see all these kids from all over the country embracing him and understanding and feeling, you know, connected with him through that experience was an amazing thing to see. And I think that it really helped towards Brandon as he continues to heal from that.
Why do you think
that incident?
Why do you think a moment like that can help someone heal? I mean, that experience of like telling something that maybe seems like not the triumph story, not the happy story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it gives you an outlet to create something based on a traumatic experience, gives you an opportunity to deal with that experience in a different way. And Brandon's experience, unfortunately, was not unique. there were so many other kids in that audience who could feel his pain based on things that they had actually experienced, that it becomes a way to help others as well.
Let's talk about your own work as a poet, because you are a poet in your own right. What inspires you?
I really, up until this point, have done a lot of topical things. Definitely dealing with the African-American experience. That's very important to me. My spirituality, you know, as a follower of Christ, I try not to run around throwing Bibles at people, but that finds its way into my work. And I think that that's important. But as I've grown, I also am trying to incorporate more of my personal experiences, and not necessarily being like a confessional poet, but I think that because I've always dealt with topical things, I've always been able to keep a safe distance. And you learn so much from young people. Like, I want to be able to do what Brandon did, you know, and to be courageous enough to deal with some of those things that have haunted me.
Ah, the mentor becomes the mentee.
Exactly.
Well, I want to hear one of your, this is a more topical piece, but it's also from a collaboration you did with Bobby Watson about a year ago from an album called Check Cashing Day. It was by Bobby Watson and the I Have a Dream Project. So tell me a little bit about that collaboration.
Oh, that's incredible. And that would fall under our next steps category, because that's one of the projects that's really starting to build, that's starting to grow and gain attention. But Bobby wanted to do a project that commemorated the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. We always hear the I Have a Dream part, but the first half of that speech, Dr. King was saying in 1865 with the Emancipation Proclamation, America wrote a promissory note that it has yet to fulfill. So we're here today to cash a check. So that's where he came up. Well, actually, him and Pam, his wife, came up with the name Check Cashing Day. So his initial thought was to have snippets of Dr. King's speech in it, but then thought it might be more contemporary and relevant to have some spoken word. That's when he called me. And then it turned into, rather than me doing a poem for that particular piece of music, I ended up doing poetry for four or five other selections on that CD as well. So we're headed to Philly in June to do a performance of that with the band that Bobby put together for that project. So it was very exciting.
Very cool. Well, let's listen to a little bit of 40 Acres and a Mule.
I'm tired of welfare handouts and being played for a fool. I'm also tired of waiting for my 40 acres and a mule. Sick of being miseducated in this country's so-called schools. Ain't none of them teachers talking about my 40 acres and a mule. I bet you'd sing a different tune if it was me that owed something to you. Save all the double talk and get my 40 acres and a mule. You keep smiling in my face, but I know your heart is cruel. Why else wouldn't you give me my 40 acres and a mule? And why am I the one always getting arrested when you're the one breaking the rules? You know my next question. Where the hell's my 40 acres and a mule?
So, Glenn North, that was from your collaboration with Bobby Watson on Check Cashing Day with the I Have a Dream Project. Tell us about that selection, like the music of it.
That was my inner angry black man. sometimes I think that you have to push yourself, and sometimes collaboration puts you in that place. And that was certainly the case with working with Bobby. But there are still things that are frustrating when it comes to race relations in America. And sometimes people are very uncomfortable with anger. So I was trying to find the tone and tenor that would express anger, but not just be totally over the top.
So let's talk about that. You sort of laughed when you said that you had this inner angry black man. Right. Do you feel like it's hard to allow yourself to be angry because of like stereotypes and expectations?
Absolutely. First of all, I'm very laid back and it takes a lot to get me upset. But when I look at certain situations when, you know, I'm dealing with it on a daily basis, and I'm not one to pull the race card just because. But, you know, it's still something that we're struggling with. And sometimes when you're just trying to live your life, or, you know, you walk in a mall and you know that somebody's following you because they think you might take something, or if you're dealing with issues, you know, in the academic arena, I know that there were times when, you know, I'm pursuing my MFA at UMKC. They have a wonderful creative writing department. You know, I took this one class, and there was this gentleman in the class who we'd be looking at these poems, and he'd somehow always figure out a way to incorporate some negative thing to say about Black people in that discussion. And wanting to confront that without looking like, you know, maybe I'm making too much of this. You know, it becomes difficult to navigate sometimes.
Well, that's understandable. We'll get back to this conversation with Glenn North about his work, his poetry, his future, and his career at the American Jazz Museum, where he has just recently resigned. And we're looking forward to the rest of this conversation after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Glenn North, who has had a wonderful career at the American Jazz Museum, being at the heart of Kansas City's spoken word scene as the poet in residence there. He's recently left that position, and we're looking back at the last 10 years of it with him, and also looking at his career as a poet, looking forward at what's next. We'd love to hear from you, speaking of what's next, at 816-235-2888. Tell us what you'd like to see at the American Jazz Museum. What would you hope for the future of that institution? That number again is 816-235-2888. And Glenn, in the meantime, let's look back at your career a little bit more. I want to travel a little bit further back. In 2009, you were a Charlotte Street resident, and there was a performance of yours that I came across on the Charlotte Street website that absolutely gives me the chills. It's called WBLK. We're going to listen to it shortly, but I wonder if you can set it up for us.
Well, WBLK is a poem that I wrote that was an experiment in satire. As I said earlier, I grew up listening to hip hop, and I was listening to the radio one day, and I was just listening to all the negative messages that were coming out of hip hop. And so I'm still a huge fan, but I wanted to deal with that and then use the poem as a vehicle to deal with several different issues, using the voice of a radio announcer. So that's how it all kind of came together.
Why the voice of a radio announcer?
Well, the idea came from listening to radio. And by doing it in the voice of that concept gave me room to touch on all these different things within one poem. So it was one of the few times where the poem just kind of, as soon as I had the idea, just kind of came together.
Okay, well, let's listen to Glenn North's WBLK.
For tuning in, you are now down with the sounds of WBLK 00.0 on your FM dial, and I'm DJ Tongue Tied, here to get you through your live drive at 5. Be sure to stay tuned as we get you cranked up with the new shiznit from the crew that brought you the number one hit, I Need a Gangbanging Chick. It's the Blood Money Bros with their new fat track, I Be Smacking My Hoes. But first, we have an important announcement from the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. Tyrone Jackson, who is Sharice Brown's baby's daddy, is missing. Although he was spotted on the corner of Linwood and Truce, no one currently knows his whereabouts. Sharice says, Tyrone, if you're out there listening, please stop tripping and call home. Little baby Tyrese is running low on Similac, and he's wearing his last pamper. More hot jams coming up, but before we get into this next set, I just wanted to remind our listeners that we still have those free tickets to Leroy's Liquor Lounge and Dinner Playhouse, where this will be the opening weekend of the Feel Good musical. The Jeffersons have some good times when they are reunited with their homeboys from outer space.
starring Sherman Hemsley, Isabel Sanford, and Jimmy J.J. Walker, with a special guest appearance by John Amos, recreating his role as James Evans, who will miraculously return from the grave to search for another job. Just be calling number 13 and the tickets are yours. By the way, Leroy wants all you listeners out there to be sure and try his new dessert, chicken fried watermelon. How good is it? Like Jack told Helen, it ain't no telling. You gotta taste it yourself. Now, in response to the brother that called in asking why we never played the real hip-hop, let me just say, you can't keep it real and keep getting paid. We got to do what Mr. Charlie says, so you won't be hearing no Public Enemy or no Dead Prez. No Eric B. and Rakim, because we bow down to the man, and he don't want y'all to be thinking of no master plan. See, we got to mix the cuss to keep your thoughts mixed up. Most of our listeners dig it. Even our white ones, too. What KRS-One said is so very true. What goes around comes around, I figure. Now we got white kids calling themselves niggas. Just look at our call letters, WBLK. We basically lack knowledge, and we like it that way. Hey, don't you dare turn that down from the station that pays. We got plenty of prizes and more giveaways. If I announce your name from off our fax line, you got 666 seconds to drop us a dime. Your prize package will include a free lifetime membership to Blockbuster Video, which will give you the chance to rent plenty of great movies like The Legend of Bagger Vance. Or, if Stephen King is more like your style, call up your friends and check out The Green Mile. Guaranteed to be in stock. Both films are centered around mystical darkies who use their magical powers to benefit the white men that they love without ever using those same powers to help themselves. These motion pictures will astound and amaze. Who says there aren't any good roles for black actors these days? Now, before we get back to our stacks of fat tracks, this evening's weather report is being brought to you by Pete's Pawn Shop, which carries the diamonds you need if you want to rock the ice and the guns you need if you can't pay the price. Tonight's forecast calls for complete darkness, which should be perfectly suitable for a community that lacks vision, and you can expect widely scattered ignorance in the morning. Oh yes, this just in from Geechee Dave in our traffic copter, the eye in the sky, lack of direction has collided with mass confusion, causing a huge pileup at the intersection of 39th and Prospect. Traffic is backed up so far on 71 Highway that no progress is expected for another 400 years. Well, that's it for your weather and traffic, and now it's time to jam. And remember, we'll keep playing the hits as long as you keep listening.
Glenn.
Yes.
You can hear the audience responding to that with a combination of disbelief and appreciation and maybe some shock during that performance. You're not shying away from controversial subject matter here, but what about that element of shock?
Well, I do want to there's a phrase or a quote about what artists should do, and I might be messing it up a bit, but we want to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And I think sometimes people need to feel not shock for shock's sake, but sometimes people need to be jarred a little bit to maybe see things differently or to think in a way that they may not have thought before, you know.
You're doing that using a very specifically Kansas City perspective down to exact intersections. What are you trying to call out there? I mean, do you gain something by naming these places and calling out what's going on there in your poetry?
Yeah, I think one of the things that you learn as a writer, just from a craft perspective, is that there's universality and specificity, right? And so you want to be specific in terms of describing things. But I'm also wanting to represent Kansas City. So I'm always thinking about ways to incorporate local flavor. But, you know, by talking about Troost, by talking about 39th and Prospect, you know, Troost is still kind of a it's a barrier. You know, you think about what happens east of Troost versus what happens west of Troost. And, you know, at the time, 39th and Prospect, I had done some work there with a group of young people who were in a juvenile detention center. And so I was seeing a lot of what was going on 39th and Prospect. prospect. So it just found its way into the poem.
Let's talk to Kevin in Northeast Kansas City. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, I was calling because I wanted to give a big Kansas City hug to our great asset, Glenn North. I've been following him since I've been here. I worked with him at the museum. We love him. We love the work he's done. And I've seen personally, firsthand, the impact he's had on real people, people who would never have thought about higher education, higher thought, higher knowledge. Glenn, he's very modest, but he's done some great things for being such a young man, and we can't wait to see what you're doing next. I got to imagine you're going to the national stage. I can see you on television. I can see you producing programs that you've done here, elsewhere. Tell us, what's the big news?
Yeah,
well,
Kev,
the big news, well, I don't know, Gina, this is your show.
That's what I want to know.
But first of all, thank you so much. Kevin and I worked together, obviously, at the American Jazz Museum. He was our marketing director for a time. But first of all, I've done so many collaborations over the past 10 years, and I've done so much in terms of, you know, creating opportunities for other, you know, poets, which I love. I've done a lot of work in terms of collaborating with musicians, visual artists, and I am now wanting to dig into what it is that I have to say. Just what do I really have to add to the conversation at this point, you know, as a 40-year-old black man in this city and in this country? I also have a project that I don't want to speak on yet. I just want to whet your appetite to bring me back.
Okay. So I'm that, listening.
Doing some selfish promotion. But there's a... In terms of African-American arts and culture, I think that I'm working with some people that will help create a space for that to expand on what I was doing at the museum, but in a broader sense. And obviously, finishing my education, I told you I'd started on my MFA, but working full time, a lot of the things that I was doing in the community just got in the way of that, quite frankly. And
yeah.
I'm not the best student in the world, to be honest with you. So I really want to focus on that, and I want to get that taken care of.
It's a full-time job.
Yeah.
Well, Glenn North, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. I'm really excited for the next chapter of the Glenn North story.
I am too.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and this has been a conversation with Glenn North, who built and nurtured Kansas City's spoken word community from his post at the American Jazz Museum, a post he's now leaving behind to focus on his art. And now... Why don't you talk? It's time for the weekly Tell KCUR segment here on Central Standard. That's when we ask you, our listeners, a question and report back on your answers. Last weekend, MU's Michael Sam became the first openly gay football player to be drafted by the NFL. ESPN cameras captured the moment when Sam received the call letting him know he had been drafted by the St. Louis Rams. So sports fans saw the tearful football player kiss his boyfriend on national television. That's the event that triggered this week's question. Allison Rollitz, social media producer here at KCUR, brings us more on that. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Gina. It's great to be back.
Thanks. Well, it's great to have you, as always. What was the question?
Well, Gina, this week we asked, is the NFL ready for Michael Sam? Why or why not? And, you know, a lot of times we'll ask the question like a slightly different way. This week, one iteration was we asked, is the macho NFL ready for Michael Sam? And that iteration in particular triggered a couple of responses. For instance, on Twitter, American Putz tweeted us, Mike Sam is more macho than most. I think that's part of the low-level nervous breakdown on Twitter.
Well, describe the low-level nervous breakdown.
For anyone that was watching on social media, there was certainly a lot of support for Michael Sam. But there, for all the support, there were some negative comments. There was a comment by a current NFL player who ended up being fined. There was a former NFL player who was concerned about the kiss between him and his boyfriend being shown on TV. And, you know, a lot of people came back kind of accusing those people of being homophobic. So there was a lot of back and forth. And certainly while Matt was supportive, wasn't all positive. We also had this phone message from a woman who said having a gay football player isn't new, and it certainly doesn't hurt the NFL's macho image.
I cannot believe that everybody seems to think that this is the first person, even though he's openly gay, to be in the NFL. The NFL players know other gay people, and they play with them, and I don't see that it's hurt the macho image at all. Macho image isn't about sexuality. It's about can you live the fire, guts, and brimstone of the NFL. Thank you.
I love that she takes it upon herself to really explore what macho means.
I know. I like her definition's pretty fun, actually.
Well, how did people answer your question of whether the NFL is ready?
Well, first off, I like to say how they didn't answer the question. We did not get a single no. Like, no one said, no, the NFL is not ready. Most of them were yeses. For instance, Caleb, he tweeted us, yes, there are miles to go before all players will understand the LGBT community. And he really compared it to race struggle. And then T-Hod, 1982, remember that we're talking about Twitter handles here, put it a different way. T-Hod said, is the NFL ready for an intelligent, stable, gifted athlete who will bring loads of cash and new fans to the league? I think so.
Ah, new demographics to tap into.
Yeah. Marketing, right? And then we had Russ of Bonner Springs. You know, people can tweet us. They can put a comment on Facebook, but they also can call in. And Russ from Bonner Springs, he summed up a lot of the yeses in this phone message. He tells us that the NFL has accepted Sam's sexuality and the fact that they made a conscious decision to draft him.
By definition, the NFL is ready. After all, the NFL is not composed of the people calling in or sending you email or tweeting. It's composed of the teams. The Rams are a major team. They made a decision. Therefore, a powerful segment of the NFL has made the decision. Enough said.
You know, we also had several does it really matter? We also had a couple maybes. For instance, Eric, he tweeted us, the NFL as a management structure is probably no less ready than similar organizations in U.S. society. But then he asked this question, Gina, but are older NFL fans ready?
Well, that's kind of interesting. So he's seeing maybe that there's a generational discrepancy that maybe applies to the fans, for example.
Yeah, that's actually something that came up a little bit. On Facebook, Tom, he talks about that, quote, it is largely a generational thing. I have seen such a big change of attitudes by younger people, certainly under the age of 30. That said, my mother is 95 years old, and she told me she saw Michael Sam's kiss and thought it was so sweet.
Oh,
I know.
Well, so we need to accept that older people are individuals, too.
Of course. And then just to kind of end up the yes, no's and or yeses and maybes, I liked this tweet from Lisa. She said, ready or not, here he comes.
So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the point is that it's not so much whether people are ready. It's that this is happening
mm-hmm,
now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, did our listeners have any predictions regarding his football career that went beyond just are people ready?
Well, we had some predictions, but we also had some people that were responding to the to basically some of that negative response I was talking to about earlier. Zane had said that the NFL is ready, but I'm not sure these pathetic bigots are ready for it. They need to not hide behind a Bible or political stance. And this is coming from a conservative Republican Christian from Kansas.
So that's interesting. He was calling out people he perceived to be bigots in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then kind of on Facebook, Gabby kind of wraps things up. You know, she says things will calm down and he'll just be another player. And that's as it should be.
And is that kind of the overall message you would say that our listeners had?
I don't know if there was an overall message, but I think since no one said no, I think that's probably what a lot of them are feeling.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for being here, as always.
Thank you, Gina. And as always, the conversation continues online. If you're hearing this and you want to tell us your opinions on the Michael Sam controversy, tweet us with the TellKCR hashtag. And now we leave you with a song that one of our Facebookers said reminded him of the on-air kiss.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh.
the fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. All that you can rely, the future brings as time goes by.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's Central Standard. If you enjoyed our discussion about Michael Sam, we'll continue that conversation on Monday, looking at how the Midwest is changing in terms of gay acceptance. Join us for that on Monday morning at 10. To listen to today's show, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Again, that's kcur.org/centralstandard, where you can download the conversation later today and all the previous conversations you've heard on Central Standard. You can stay current on Central Standard News by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @kcurcst. Tomorrow, the food critics dish on wings, so if you like to eat wings, that's a show for you. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today's Central Standard. But stay tuned for Up to Date, coming up next.